This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm really pleased to have in the studio with me Jacob Hacker, director of the Institution for Social and Policy Studies and professor of political science at Yale University. He's the author of many articles and books, which you might have read, including Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, which he wrote with Paul Pearson. Jacob Hacker, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks so much for having me on, Matt.
Well, I love this book, and I think it's really important, and it deals with the basic issue of our time, I think, an issue that we're seeing play out in the streets of New York City and many other cities around the country, and in fact, around the world. What do you make of the Occupy Wall Street?
Well, obviously, I think it's very encouraging that people are actually talking about the huge gap between the very rich and the rest, and the slogan that the Occupy Wall Street movement has taken on, the other 99%, kind of perfectly expresses the argument at the heart of Paul's and my book. And we argue that over the last generation, the very richest, the top 1%, the top 1/10 of 1%, have pulled dramatically away from the rest of Americans. And that's really the story of rising inequality. It's not about the bottom falling away from the middle. It's not about sort of the rungs of the ladder getting farther apart in general. It's really about how the very, very rich have gotten fabulously richer over a period in which middle-class incomes and earnings have been stagnant, and over a period in which middle-class Americans have had to take on a lot more debt and have been a lot more at risk economically than they used to be. And the fact that we're, you know, 3-4 years into this huge economic crisis and we're finally seeing a concerted grassroots effort to try to bring this to the fore, I think is really encouraging.
How did that top 1% or 0.1% manage to make out like bandits when the rest of us weren't?
Well, if you listen to those at the top, it's, of course, because they're smarter than we are. If you a few years ago, New York Times had a profile of Sandy Weill, the former head of Citigroup, who had given all this money to the Metropolitan Opera or some other good cause in New York. And he said, "We didn't wait for somebody else to build what we did. He said, you know, this has been an incredibly unique period of time. And the implication, and I think a lot of those at the top believe this, was that it really, you know, Sandy Weill was a self-made man who had really surfed the waves of this new global economy and created great value for our society as a whole. Well, it's pretty hard to believe that after people like Sandy Weill basically took our economy to the brink and had to be bailed out. And in fact, as we show in the book, it wasn't some kind of natural market development that led to this sharp inequality in the United States. For example, if you go to Sandy Weill's office before the meltdown, when he still had an office, you would see on the wall a big plaque, apparently about 4 feet wide, and on it was his picture, and etched below it was Sandy Weill, Shatterer of Glass-Steagall. Now, for those who don't know the inside baseball of financial regulation, Glass-Steagall was the law that separated banks and financial investment firms. It basically said that you couldn't play the casino with other people's life savings. And so this repeal was led by a lobbying effort that Sandy Weill was spearheading. And so, sure, he didn't wait for somebody else to build what he had, but he certainly wasn't shy about pressing government to change policy. And we show that again and again over the 1990s and 2000s, policies like financial deregulation, the gutting of unions, corporate governance and accounting rules that made it easier for CEOs to bump up their pay, and tax policies that basically allowed the rich to pay lower taxes even as they got fabulously richer, that all these were shaped by government policy, and the politics that produced it was one where those like Sandy Weill that had lots of influence and lobbying clout were able to get policies that hurt the middle class.
I'm speaking with Jacob Hacker. He is the author of this very important book called Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class, which he wrote with Paul Pearson. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at The Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. The question people who are concerned about our democracy, as I am and as you are and as I'm sure the listener is too, is how can this happen in a country that's supposed to be a democracy? You have a phrase in this book called unrepresentative democracy. Obviously, if we had a functional democracy, it wouldn't be rewarding people at the very top and letting other vast majority of people suffer.
Yeah, I mean, that's the great puzzle at the heart of the book. Democracy is not supposed to be good at a lot of things, but one thing it's supposed to be good at is representing the interests of broad majorities of citizens. And in this case, the most Americans have been, you know, on the sidelines watching this great yacht of wealth go by, or even sometimes in the path in the path of it. So how did this happen? And we argue that the common mistake that analysts make when they start to look at American politics is to assume that the story is all about elections, right? So, you know, it's the question is, how do Republicans win elections, basically? You know, Tom Frank's wonderful book, What's the Matter with Kansas? They win elections because they gin people up on social issues. And what we point out is that it's not just about elections. It's about organization. It's about which segments of society, which economic interests have the ability to organize for the long haul to reshape governance. Because that's, after all, what's really important to most groups. I mean, look at the Koch brothers, for example, right? David Koch recently said, our main concern is not elections, our concern is changing policy, right? So they don't think of elections as the goal. They think of elections as the training ground or the means to the end of the real season, which is changing policy. So in the book, we talk about how in the 1970s, there was a real counter-mobilization of business. And it was a counter-mobilization because, after all, if you go back to that period, there was this big social movements of the 60s and early 70s. And then what really scared business was the environmental and consumer protection movements, Ralph Nader and environmental crusaders that really put business back on its heels. And there's a famous memo written by Lewis Powell, the so-called Powell Memorandum, where he says, you know, business of the world, businessmen of the world, unite. We've got to get together. We've got to be organized. We have to connect across legislative issues. We have to be based in Washington. We have to get more sophisticated. We have to reach out to members of Congress. And they did it. And by the late 1970s, even as Democrats had the White House and both houses of Congress, they had totally turned the tide. So an example we talk about in the book is in 1978, there was a major labor law reform bill that looked a lot like, in fact, it was more robust than the Employee Free Choice Act that bit the dust a few years ago. It was a sure thing, according to everyone. But business pulled out all the stops, managed to defeat it with a filibuster, which was almost unheard of at the time, right? This what's become normal. The filibuster was rare then. And so in 1978, this bill went down. So did efforts to try to link the minimum wage to inflation so it would rise over time. A whole host of other progressive causes bit the dust. By the end of the 70s, even before Reagan comes into office, there's this big capital gains tax cut. So the illustration there is that it wasn't the elections. It wasn't Jimmy Carter's election or Democrats' election in 1976 that mattered. What mattered the most there was this organization, and the organization carried through and, as we show, became even more intense and more effective over the next 25 years.
It's also true of your Sandy Weill example because, of course, Glass-Steagall fell in 99 when Bill Clinton was president.
Yeah, there's actually a great story about that. So at the sign at the ceremony where they were celebrating the forming of Citigroup, which was, of course, a uniting, I think, Travelers and Citibank, the other CEO involved in the deal was there at the signing ceremony, and one reporter had the temerity to ask, well, guys, what about Glass-Steagall? Can you do this? And he's and the other guy said, oh, don't worry, Sandy will talk to his friend, the president. So, yeah, I mean, it's clear that financial deregulation was pushed by the Democratic Party as well as the Republican Party, and one of the key reasons was that there was so much money coming into the Democratic Party from Wall Street.
So they did it. The Democratic Party did it. Bill Clinton did it because he wanted to get money for re-election of Democrats.
Yeah.
But in the process, they threw Democratic principles overboard.
That's right. It was a Faustian bargain. And we really saw that in the most recent financial crisis, because if Democrats had been able to present a clear, viable alternative to Republicans, if they hadn't been tarred with the bailout brush, I think it would have been a very different – things would have played out very differently in 2009 and 2010. So, the greatest challenge for President Obama was he came in at this moment of economic crisis, right? He was almost a de facto president by the end of the campaign. No one thought McCain could deal with this. And he bought into the Bush bailouts, right? Did not distinguish himself clearly. And so while most Americans still understand that the economy tanked under President George W. Bush, they do not see a big difference between Democrats and Republicans and between Obama and his Republican critics on the bailouts. And I think that is a real problem. And it reflects both policy failures on the part of the administration, but also the failure to grasp the symbolic importance of being distinct
From, so what should Obama have done on this issue?
Well, I think, first of all, he should have adopted a much harder line on Wall Street. I mean, yes, Wall Street folks are complaining incessantly about how evil he is. I think one financier compared his policy for taxing hedge fund interest at the same rate that normal people pay on their income, hedge fund incomes at the same rate that normal people pay on their income, as like when Hitler invaded Poland, right?
A little bit over the top.
Yeah, a little over the top. I mean, Obama talked about fat cats maybe once, and suddenly all these businessmen and Wall Street folks are saying that they're being vilified. Go back to Roosevelt. He said, I welcome their hatred, right, about economic royalists, as he called them. And I don't think that it was just that Obama should have had tougher language. He should have had tougher policies, right? The administration was so concerned about the fragility of the economy, understandably, that they did not think much about the long-term implications of basically propping Wall Street back up so that you could have the same basic framework going forward. Now, Wall Street has recovered, but the rest of the economy hasn't, and the resentment that most Americans feel towards Wall Street is not being channeled into support for Democrats or President Obama, but into cynicism and distrust of the political system as a whole. So it's a terrible outcome. Obama was dealt actually pretty tough hand, but I think that was one area where he played that hand very poorly.
I'm speaking with Jacob Hacker. He's a political science professor at Yale, co-author of Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I've always thought that what Obama should have done was make the bankers concede something that would help the American people, write down principal by 25% on everyone's mortgage. 60 million people, 55 million people, families would have been helped, or impose a moratorium on foreclosures, anything that would have helped people. But as a consequence, people see the bankers being helped and everyone else being... You know, what's the slogan? Banks got bailed out, we got sold out.
Yeah, and I think that that's a great idea. In fact, one of the features of this downturn that I think wasn't well enough appreciated, at least by the sort of mainstream economists within the White House, was the extent to which, as a financial crisis, it was really deeply a wealth crisis for middle-class Americans who are now drowning in debt, right, with their main asset, for those who had assets, being their home worth much less.
Yeah, you say your book depreciated by 40%. I didn't realize it was that much, but that's enormous.
In my last book, The Great Risk Shift, I talked about how these trends had already been taking place well before the downturn. In 2006, I published The Great Risk Shift, which is really about the increased risk that middle-class families were having to bear. So this came on top of this long-term trend. And the fact is that in the same way that the run-up of home prices encouraged people to spend, the decline of home prices and the increase in foreclosures and the number of people who are underwater basically was a huge contraction within the economy that doesn't show up in income but shows up in wealth. And so you're absolutely right. Something that would have dealt with that immediately would have had much more of a stimulative effect than anything else the government could have done. And yet, for a variety of reasons, that was completely off the table.
Well, so what were some of those reasons? I know that Geithner kept saying, you know, we can't do anything because the system's so fragile and, you know, we can't be a bad cop here because people will start to quake in their boots and the market will go way down and then things will be worse.
Okay. I think it was political timidity was part of it, right? There was a recognition that this was necessary, but a worry that, if we force the banks to write down mortgages, or if we much more aggressively come up with ways to try to reduce the debt that people are bearing, that will be rewarding people who made poor decisions in the past, right? So the very limited efforts that were made have been hamstrung by the fact that they were much, much too timid. The problem is that, yeah, there were some political hits you might take on that. There were certainly going to be people who felt like that was a bailout. Remember, the Tea Party started with Rick Santelli's, you know, raging on the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange saying, you know, we have to bail out all these losers and their mortgages. So there would have been backlash, but there was going to be backlash no matter what. As it is, the president has taken these huge political blows, right? Losing the House, failing to achieve some of his key goals, completely hamstrung now, right? But without a lot of the political and economic gain, right? I mean, if the economy was strong in 2010 or it was strong now, we would not be talking about how President Obama may be a one-term president. We would also not be talking about the extent to which the greatest opportunity for progressive reform of my lifetime, right, has already passed.
Yeah, it was brutal.
Yeah, it was not a fun. I was working on healthcare during this period, and I'm often credited as the father of the public option, the idea of allowing people to buy into a Medicare-like public plan. And so I can tell you, I saw the brutality firsthand. I got some emails that I wouldn't even share with my enemies. So tough.
I mean, this is also, I'm speaking with Jacob Hacker, who did play a big role in this healthcare debate, only to see the public option be thrown overboard. I always thought Obama was playing progressives for chumps. He played you for a chump, I suppose, because I didn't think, I just never thought he was going to go for the public option. I thought he was just dangling it there, and he kept undercutting it with his rhetoric by saying it's just a small piece of the pie. There are more important moral issues like getting everybody covered. And he also, you know, he threw out universal health care for starters. Anyway, so it was like almost betrayal of the progressive base on health care that wanted to see Medicare for all, or at least Medicare for all who want it.
Yeah, needless to say, there were times of great frustration during the debate. And it wasn't just Obama who frustrated me. When Joe Lieberman, my home state senator, essentially killed off the public option, he actually said that one of the reasons he was against a compromise on the public option is that I was for it. And I was flabbergasted, not only that Joe Lieberman knew who I was, but that he would make important decisions based on what I thought. I also thought it was, you know, this presented an opportunity I hadn't been aware of. So, for example, maybe I should have been for the Iraq War, so, you know, that Joe Lieberman would come out and against it. In any case, Obama had, a very tough hand on health care. And he had to achieve this filibuster-proof, you know, reform. They probably could have done more through the budget process, which would have allowed them to win early victories and more than symbolic victories, like real changes in the law, but through the budget process that wouldn't have been subject to a filibuster. But, you know, they really did face this huge juggernaut of organized opposition. They had to try to buy off all these interest groups. To me, despite the fact that I was deeply disappointed with the final compromise compared with what I would have wanted, I think it's probably the case in which Obama got the closest to what he was seeking. And in that respect, it just shows how screwed up our political system is, mm-hmm. right? That bill was if that was the best that progressives could do, given Democratic majorities in both House of Congresses and a president who reportedly pushed his aides again and again to keep on this issue, even though they wanted to back away, that's really suggestive of the extent to which money matters more than, you know, votes, and of the extent to which this polarized system where the right in particular has moved radically away from the center and is now willing to use incendiary rhetoric, organization, suppression of voters, a lot of strategies that were considered sort of outside the bounds of the normal in the past to get what they want. That has really made lawmaking almost impossible. And look at what happened on the debt ceiling, right?
And that was hostage taking, no doubt.
It was, and so too with the tax cuts that were extended. I mean, this hostage taking politics of the sort that we've seen lately is a new development. I can't think of comparable periods. Let's go back to the fights over budget in 1993 and 1990. I mean, one was a Republican president, one was a Democratic president, Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush. Both of those were measures that involved bipartisan compromise. They involved tax increases as well as spending cuts. If you look at the deal that President Obama said he might be willing to support during the debt ceiling debate, it was far, far to the right of anything that would have been considered in 93 or 90. And that is a measure of how far the Republicans have moved to the right. Public opinion hasn't shifted that far to the right.
And the Democrats, too,
for that matter. I mean, and so you said unresponsive democracy.
Right.
I mean, look at the...
Unrepresentative
democracy. Look at the polls on raising taxes on the rich, right? Some people say, well, it's not surprising most people would want to raise taxes on someone else. But, you know, Americans are generally very averse to the idea of resenting people who've done well in the economy. Again and again, though, the polls are showing that people believe, overwhelmingly, even Republicans, majority of Republicans, believe that we should raise taxes on the rich to close the deficit, that that's a much better option than say, slashing Medicare or Social Security. And again, right, that has died. And it's died not just because of Republicans. I mean, I think 43 House Democrats wrote a letter to Nancy Pelosi saying they weren't going to go along with repealing the upper income Bush tax cuts. So those Bush tax cuts, which were supposed to be sunsetted and go off into the distance, those seem to be a permanent feature of our politics right now. And they are because of the unrepresentativeness of our democracy, not because Americans don't believe that core elements of them should be left to expire.
Speaking with Jacob Hawker, who's the author of Winner Take All Politics, co-author of the book, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at The Progressive. This is Progressive Magazine. So there are these kinks in the hose of democracy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just not, you know, what the people want is not connected to what the people get ultimately. And even with some Democrats going, is it just they're in the pocket of that top 1% that's giving the lion's share of the money to the campaigns? It's as simple as that?
It's not as simple as that, but that's a big part of it. I mean, campaign finance is a huge problem in the United States, and it's gotten much worse, right, with the Citizens United decision, with the evisceration of even sort of modest campaign finance rules by the Supreme Court. And that trend is going to continue. But it's not just campaign finance. It's not just that it's not just that American politics follows the golden rule, he who has the gold rules. It's also in my mind, an organizational imbalance. And that's where I think the greatest opportunity for change is. It's not just that the affluent can donate more money. It's that they have a lobbying apparatus that's far more advanced, sophisticated, and long-term in its focus. And at the same time, and this is really important, there is a coordinated infrastructure around conservative causes, activists and organizations that have risen up. These are not all these mass-based organizations. Obviously, the Tea Party has a broad grassroots presence. These are also elite organizations like Koch's ALEC, right, the American Legislative Exchange Council, which focuses on getting states to adopt policies, conservative policies at the same time. Or it's Grover Norquist, Americans for Tax Reform, right? Norquist is basically a one-man conservative juggernaut, right? He created the idea of these pledges that Republicans and some Democrats sign on to say, we will never raise taxes. If you put my mother on the train tracks and drive the train towards her, I will still not raise taxes, right? You know, that is, I don't think that's in the pledge, but, you know, that's the sentiment. So this is a really important development. Elite recruitment, certification, and primary challenges by conservatives. The activist Republican base is far more organized, far more densely organized, far more coordinated than what we see on the other side of the political spectrum. And if Occupy Wall Street has a positive legacy for this terrible set of developments, it would be to help foster some organization on the other side, some sustained effort to push back against what's happening, because we really are losing our democracy.
What would that look like? It would be like Howard Dean's Brothers Organized for America group writ large, or something much more powerful?
Well, first of all, let's all be humble in this, right? How many of us predicted Occupy Wall Street would either emerge or have the kind of lasting power it has? One thing we know for sure is that an organization that is successful in contemporary American politics has to have three elements, right? It has to have a grassroots presence. It has to have a focus on villains and on an agenda. And third, and it has to benefit from the new social media. Those are the three things that the Tea Party did, and these are the three things that Occupy Wall Street may well yet develop.
It's got 2 3/4
right,
of the
exactly.
three. It's got everything but the agenda.
And I think
it's been criticized by a lot of people for not having an agenda right out of the gate, but I thought that was kind of premature criticism.
I agree. And it's sort of a joke if you think about it, because, basically this group has been around, this movement has been around for such a short period of time. And at the same time, it is a bunch of anarchists. A lot of the people involved are anarchists, by which I mean people who have real skepticism about government. And so, you know, anarchists are probably not the best person to come up with long-term policy agendas. What I do know is that historically, social movements have linked up with elite politicians who are concerned about the same cause. So the progressive era, for example, social movements linked up with people in politics. Teddy Roosevelt, for example, in the New Deal, social movements linked up with Robert Wagner, right, who pushed for labor law reforms. So that's what's going to have to happen with Occupy Wall Street. It's not going to be co-opted. It has to be cooperated with, right? It has to gain broader presence. It has to hook up with organizations like the labor movement, like activist organizations concerned about other issues, like Move On. That's going to be the way in which it comes to have this organized presence. But let's not forget that the real problem in American politics is not just that Republicans have won elections. The real problem is that there has been no organized pushback or counterweight against those who are doing the bidding of the very, very well off. And that is only going to happen through this kind of institutional development, this long-term institutional development.
Labor hasn't been strong enough. Ralph Nader's old citizens groups haven't been powerful enough.
Well, lots of citizens groups, we do point out in the book, have tended not to focus on bread or butter economic issues. I hope that that's something that's changing, as we recognize that we can't have an environmental movement or women's rights movement without also having a commitment to economic justice.
Speaking with Jacob Hacker, he is the co-author of Winner Take All Politics, How Washington Made the Rich Richer and Turned Its Back on the Middle Class. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive. This is Progressive Radio. You talked about Obama's timidity, and in your book you have an incredible passage about what progressives need to do, and we've just been talking about this. Progressives will have to confront an inconvenient truth. They're losing on economic issues, not because Americans' judgments are clouded by social issues or racial animosity, Tom Frank's thing, but because battered by the economic trends, many middle-class Americans are wondering whether progressives can really deliver a better economic life, and perhaps most challenging, progressives are losing because the well of public trust in government's been so badly poisoned by the failures of government to deliver that life in the recent past. I think that was the problem. The stimulus, stimulus wasn't big enough, and people can't see it. You know, to say it would have been worse if we didn't do this is just a real hard sell for people who lost their job and lost their house.
Lose their house twice. Yeah, this is really the catch-22 of political reform, right? The only way to fix a broken political system is to work through a broken political system, not always within it, right? I think that extra-constitutional, extra-political action is essential, but ultimately, we're not going to get reform unless political leaders in government, right, change the laws, change the governing norms, change the way things operate. And I believe it's within our power. I mean, one thing that I want to point out is that the common view that we talked about at the beginning, that the rich are fabulously richer because of impersonal economic forces and their own wisdom and genius in dealing with those forces, that view is incredibly fatalistic, right? It's not like China's going to disappear tomorrow or that we're going to close our borders, unless you're talking about the borders to the south that let immigrants in. We're not going to see computers disappear from our economic scene. So if you believe this is just a natural economic trend, then change is not going to happen. However, if, as I believe, this is about politics and government and what government does, then it is completely within our power. It will be hard. It will be a struggle. We say that it was a 30-year war to create this, and probably going to be at least a 30-year war to fully reverse it, but I believe we can.
30-year war to create the kind of New Deal, Great Society system?
No, a 30-year war to create to this new it. Oligarchy that we're dealing with today.
To destroy that system.
Yes. No, it is the great challenge of our day.
We've got about 30 seconds. I'm going to just ask a short question. You mentioned the prospect of Obama being a one-term president. How likely do you think he is to be a one-term president?
Oh, so this is the kind of question political scientists love to be asked because we know the models. But what I can tell you is that two-thirds of incumbent presidents get reelected, and so the odds are in his favor. But the ones who lose, like Herbert Hoover, are ones who lose spectacularly because the economy is poor, because there's other failures on his watch. I think that the Republicans' move to the right actually is Obama's greatest advantage, and that he may well squeak through. That's where I'm putting my money right now. But the fact is, and this is what we need to address, much more fundamental problems, and Obama's getting reelected may be a precondition for addressing those problems, but it won't make it happen unless we organize and press for change.
I'm all for that. Jacob Hacker, thanks so much for being my guest today on Progressive Radio.
Thanks for having me.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.